Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week we sip fermented tea with Justin Trout, one of the co-founders and the COO of Health Aid, one of America's most favorite kombuchas. We learn about how music plays a part in the brewing process, what it means to get your own business going, and what it means to keep it in motion. Then we are at the legendary Dangerbird Record Studios, where we sit down and hear performers from brothers David and Renee, the Pacheco brothers, and their band Tropa Magica. We learn what it means to grow up in the East LA punk scene and what it means to create your own sound. So sit back and listen. Here we go. Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are here with Justin Trout, co-founder and COO of Health Aid Kombucha, sipping on some delicious. Can I call it the Booch? Kombuch? What's the nickname?
Geez, you know.
If I want to be like an insider.
If you want to be an insider, we just call it Health Aid. We just drop the kombucha entirely. Yeah.
It's like Madonna.
Well, that's our whole goal eventually. Like, you just want to be like, hey, let me have a Health Aid. And that's just synonymous, right? Yeah.
I love beets.
Okay, so you're drinking the beet line.
Like, I literally, I have a reputation at work that every day I bring the salad, it has beets, and everyone's like, oh, you got your beet salad today?
They're really good.
They're really good, and they get so sweet.
Yeah, I think that if people didn't have this built-in stigma against beets, they'd like them a lot more. Beets are great. They taste awesome.
I want to know, because there's usually a thing, you know, like with tomatoes, they're like poisonous, like nightshade, back in the day. Like, I wonder when beets got their bad reputation.
I think it had to do with, like, kids or something. I don't know. Like, maybe back in the days, kids worked on the farm. And they were sick and tired of pulling up these beets all the time.
Sick and tired. So you actually didn't get your start in food. You're a trained musician.
That's my deal.
Berklee College of Music?
Yeah.
As being your first passion, what do you love about music? What inspires you?
Oh, so much. I mean, music to me, it's as someone who actually performs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing. Like, as a musician, I couldn't even possibly say what it would be like if I was a listener only.
Which right? I am.
Okay, you're a listener only.
And I'm obsessed, but there's a part of me where I go, I can't add to it.
That's fine.
I know.
Okay, that's like me in movies.
Sure.
Like anything with that, I'm like, whatever this is, yeah. Amazing. Wow. However they did that. But with music, for me, I think the art of actually playing it is so meditative.
Yeah.
It's so detailed. Like there's so much to do that there's a certain point where you can't even keep track of it all and you have to sort of trust and succumb to however it's going to be.
Mm.
And maintaining that balance through a performance is so interesting. And that's why I love so many kinds of music, because they each have their own little particular disciplines that go on throughout it. It's really fascinating.
Now, we'll get into a little bit, but now that you're a businessman, now that you run your own company, is there any disciplines from music, from studying, from that inspiration that have followed you into this career of like starting and running a CPG business?
Yeah, for sure. I don't want to be too, like, cliche, but...
Be cliche.
All right. Hard work. Learning to play an instrument very well, or even what I did at Berklee was music production and engineering. So you got a nice little XY configuration here going with your microphones. So it's so much work.
Yeah.
And you have to be a self-starter. Like, I think it would be, like, morally wrong to force someone to practice an instrument. Like, why? You know, you don't...
It is a form of torture in some part of the world.
Well, it would have to be a self-torture, but you could never force that on someone else. You'd be like, gosh, can't you do something else with your time?
Yeah,
you could. This is a dalliance that you're just really into. And so I think when you're doing a business, certainly as an entrepreneur, there's... you have got to work really hard, and you've got to be a self-starter. And then one of the things, I had a really great professor in college. We were... mixing, right? So you end up with all the different tracks. There could be many, many, many of them. And then it's really the art of balancing them so that it sounds really good through speakers. Okay, that's mixing. And he had a thing that stuck with me, and then it could just be the OCD in me saying it, and it stuck with me though. Anything you can do to make a mix better, you must do.
Right. Like if it pops into your head, you can't just ignore it.
You're not allowed.
You're not allowed to throw it out. And
no.
Yeah, I get that approach. And I guess that a lot of the times with a business and also with music, 80% of what you do is in private. 90% of what you do is in private.
Yeah, me, for sure.
You know what I mean? Like, they don't see you going over the books. They don't see you, you know, testing and failing and testing and failing. You know, they don't see you when you're getting started doing the drives to the market. No. It's like, but it's about showing up.
It's so about showing up.
So, you know, for those who are not familiar with kombucha, which is not a... I don't know anymore. Because I think there was a time when people, I would say maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it was like this mystery thing, but I live in LA now, and so I feel like everyone knows kombucha is. But, like, when did you first hear of kombucha? Did it come to you through, like, your world of musicians? Because I feel like it does sort of have that, like, left culture, hippy-dippy musician sort of vibe to it. When did you first come across it?
Okay,
and
so
what is it?
Okay, the level set.
Let's level set.
All right, level set.
So we know what mixing is.
We've defined that. I think it's a clear. If you didn't know, you got an elevator pitch for what mixing is.
Elevator pitch me on the kombucha.
Kombucha is fermented tea that's naturally rich in probiotics and healthy acids, basically. Okay, so you take, in our case, in Health Aid's case, it's green and black tea, and we brew that tea and we add sugar to it because that's the fuel for the fermentation. And we add the kombucha cultures. So if you think of like sourdough bread or yogurt or something, you can reuse and regrow the culture. Think of seed saving if you're in a farm or something like that. You put the seeds in there. And what we do is we use these 2.5 gallon glass jars. We have hundreds of thousands.
I was going to say.
Many.
You really?
Yes.
Even after you scaled up?
Yeah.
You just buy more jars.
Lots of jars.
Okay. Well. Okay.
Okay. We can always go back.
Yeah.
Lots of jars. Okay. And then so, and it ferments in there, And that fermentation throughout that process, it essentially transforms what was sweet tea with some culture in it into something that has a little bit more of a tart flavor, way less sugar. It becomes bubbly when you put it in the bottle and it ferments in the bottle. And it has probiotics, which are healthy for your gut, and that radiates in other parts of your body and has healthy acids and vitamins and things like that. And when you drink it, and the reason, I believe, why it's become so popular is simply when you drink it, it makes you feel good. I mean, plain and simple.
Oh, yeah. When I put down a bottle of Health Aid, I feel good.
There you go.
I feel like, well, I didn't make it to the gym, but I had some Health Aid.
So we have a thing where we say, we're not, like, we don't allow the word perfect at the company. It's all about the health. It's the health it takes to be happy.
Yeah.
And for us, it's like, look, if you want to do one nice thing for yourself, this is great. You don't have to also, like, have, you know, organic kale picked by a virgin in the moonlight. Like, that's okay. You
no,
can be
that's like a person. Saturday, like, every other month.
That's okay. Whatever it might be for you. Anyway, so, that's what kombucha is.
So that's kombucha is. And so when did you first have it? When did you first get introduced to it? And did you have this, like, first sip aha moment where, like, I have to get into this?
I actually did.
Okay.
Okay, so my wife is our CEO.
Shout out.
Dinah, CEO. Nice work. Co-founder.
Yeah.
And we met when we were both living in Boston. So I was going to college. She was in graduate school studying nutrition and public health and doing smart person stuff. And so I was like on a coffee and hot dog diet exclusively at that time.
I know that Boston diet well. I went to BU.
Oh!
Yeah.
We have so many connections.
I know.
Like, we have parallel lives kind of.
South Philly, Philadelphia, Boston.
I also lived like two blocks from Taste Made, FYI.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did. I used to.
Small world.
Yeah.
I love Boston.
Me too.
Honest Taqueria?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Honest Taqueria. Oh yes. My gosh. Yeah. I forgot about that till you said it.
Oh, I mean, that was my diet. Anyway.
So I worked at Atlantic Fish Company. That was my job.
Okay.
That's where Diane and I met.
Yeah.
So anyway, we digress. I had really bad, surprise, surprise, stomach issues.
What, like, processed meat and acid?
I'm like, what's going on with this, right? I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And then so I go to this doctor. Guy didn't ask me a thing about what I ate. I'm like, my stomach, real bad, problem. And he's like, I got just a thing for you. And it was like, yeah, some kind of prescription assortment. I didn't know what it was. And so I go to my then girlfriend, Dinah, and I'm like, okay, so I gotta get these prescriptions filled. Kind of a bummer, right? It is what it is. And she's like, okay, wait a minute.
Stop.
Like, can we work on this at all?
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, sure. And she said, well, I'm learning about kombucha, just fermented foods and things like that in school. And this came up. And so she goes, let's just try making it once.
What year is this?
This is 05.
So, I mean, kombucha...
Nascent. Yeah. And so, yeah, sure, we made it. I will never forget, I had like half a glass, and my stomach, right then and there, just felt better.
Like your Popeye spinach moment.
It was my Popeye spinach moment.
Yeah.
Totally. And I just thought, wow, I'm going to like have a normal meal tonight and not feel pain or anything. And I've been just doing kombucha ever since then.
Okay, so how do you go from music grad in Boston, you know, with smart girlfriend turned wife, making kombucha in what I can only imagine is a Boston-style college-type apartment, to being like, we're going to make a go of this? And not, I'm not talking about like the bottle stuff, but like, what's the next step?
Well, there's a huge gap of time in between. We didn't start the company until 2012.
But you're still making it and just drinking it for yourself.
Yeah, it's like on and off, right? Like when you make kombucha and, you know, like a lot of things, if you're like sprouting things at home, you like do it for a while, then you like take a break. You take a break. So we were doing that, right? So we'd buy kombucha or we'd make it and we kind of oscillate between that, and that was all good. And then we moved to LA in 2007 and I was a musician doing anything that could, you know, pay me as a musician.
How was that going?
Oh my gosh.
Tough.
Caps off to anybody, to everybody doing it.
And that's pre like bubble bursting recession.
Yeah, listen, I wouldn't have felt that. I was so far low. Like, I mean, oh, the bubble burst. Oh God, what's gonna happen?
What's gonna happen?
I mean, I had no, like, I wasn't like living.
You lose that one nickel to rub against the other nickel.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's a lot. So, I mean, no. So I was doing that, and so in that case, I mean, I was like, I was an assistant for producers, or I'd be like engineering, or I'd be doing my own productions for people that would pay me, and they're like a singer, and they're like, I want to be a singer, and I'm like, okay.
Good for you.
Yeah, studio musician, you know, hired gun live stuff, you know, all that, and like, found it very stressful, not surprisingly. And at a certain point, after like a lot of ups and downs and a lot of what seemed like near misses, that is a subject for another podcast.
Yeah.
You know, think you're getting there, but you're like, oh my God, no. Eventually I thought, I need to get a job.
Yeah.
Like I love music and I'm starting to not love it really that much.
Yeah, it's tough.
So I really just want a job. Let me straighten that out right now. So I ended up getting a job for this company that made like cosmetic concealants for hair loss.
Sure.
Okay, as one does.
As one does.
Sure. And then so it was a small company, it was entrepreneur owned it, and I was just fascinated by business. It pushed a lot of my buttons that music does. Like, I like detail. I like intricacy. I like when I push something, something happens.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I like being able to impact things. So all of that was going on, and I actually kind of fell in love with it. And then next thing we know, me, Diana, and our best friend Vanessa, third co-founder, we started an entrepreneur club, the three of us. And it was at night, we'd get together, you know, we want to drink kombucha while we're having this entrepreneur club because, you know, you don't want to be drinking alcohol while you're doing it. You're not really, you can't think as well and all that. So we thought of all kinds of ideas, some of which I found out later other people ran with and they became successful businesses. So I think that we have like good ideas. And anyway, it dawned on us eventually, we're like, oh my God, we got to be selling kombucha. We've been making it. Let's just go with it. We got to get started on a business. And as far as us, as a trifecta, what we call ourselves, I call it a triad, we definitely click as people and as business owners and workers together, really very, very, there's a lot of luck involved too in these things.
Oh yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break. We're going to talk about you getting the business started and then growing into what it is today. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Feel more than just fun. I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Oh, I get lost in the thrill sometimes.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We're here with Justin Trout, co-founder, CEO of Health Aid. Not saying the last name because we're going to start the trend here. So you and your triad of business partners have decided that this is the business that you're going to go with. Now, launching into the food space is hard enough, but launching a beverage or drink or something that is also that not well known, not well heard of, could come with the stigma is even harder. How did you get started? Where did you start? Did you know that you had to take baby steps, or did you go head first straight in, full guns blazing?
Head first straight in, full guns blazing.
Okay.
And the thing is, like, have you ever like had to like dive off kind of like a cliff or something into water?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not like, a lot.
Okay, I did it recently this year, and it was like the hardest thing ever. But if I had no clue of how, you know, big the jump was,
sure,
would have been a hell of a lot easier.
Right.
So there's a certain amount of like naivete.
Sure.
And we had that. And people were like, why are you going into beverage? That's so competitive. And especially there's Goliaths out there and it's very capital intensive. And these things. And we're like, what?
What?
You don't know what you're talking about. We're going to win.
Yeah.
And like, so we went with that. And it's like, there's a certain power to not knowing what you're up against. I mean, you know, if I'm a boxer, I don't really need to obsess like, oh boy, that guy hits hard. You know,
yeah,
like, I probably wouldn't do that. I think about like, I got this.
Right. You got to figure out how you're going to win.
Yeah.
So you got your recipe down.
Yeah.
And how do you go from making at-home recipe, or is there a difference between making an at-home recipe and then making something that you're going to bottle and sell?
There is no difference for us. And that was the entire thing. Like, our concept was...
That's why you have 10,000 to 2.5 gallon jars.
Many.
Many.
Yeah. Kind of. I mean, our whole thing was that, like, you know, there was at the time a market leader, and there still is.
Okay.
And, you know, for us, we thought, well, gosh, what's the point of putting out a product if there's no choice between what's available and what we offer?
Sure.
So we thought, everything we do, we want to look different, we want to be different, we want to make it differently, we want our message to be different.
Yeah.
All these different things. And so...
And what was that message? What did you decide early on that you wanted to stand out with?
Best tasting and highest quality.
I mean, it is delicious.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's how we make it.
Yeah.
And that's... We always go back to that core. I think there's a lot of like extra messaging you can put out to talk to different consumers that are maybe coming into kombucha,
yeah,
never heard of it before. You want to tailor your message to those. But at the end of the day, when you do find Health Aid and you do start to get into it, you're not going to find a better made product than how we do it.
I believe that.
You know, and so for us, going from the apartment up to, you know, different size, bigger and bigger food facilities.
So how did you do that? How did you go from the... Did you start bottling and selling out of the apartment?
Kind of.
Because that's...
You're not really allowed to
do that.
You're
not really allowed. We'll let it slide.
We didn't do that.
It's a good thing that no one listens to our podcast.
Okay, all right. So hopefully... thank God there are no listeners. Entrepreneur story.
Yeah.
Anything you can do, you got to do, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so look, we got to get into the farmer's market. We already said that we were going to do it, except for we didn't have a public health certificate.
Sure.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
It's a problem. So we figured...
Only if you get caught or if someone gets sick.
You're going to get... You will get caught.
Yeah.
And so we called around. We thought, how can we get one of these things?
Yeah.
So a friend of a friend of a friend owned a bakery.
Sure.
Like a bake shop in Manhattan Beach here in LA. And what we did was we called her up and we're like, look, you're working crazy hours. Am I right? You're waking up super early. You're like, you know, you're making the donuts and then you're selling them and it's a whole thing, right? How would you like it if three nights a week you didn't have to work in the bake shop? We did it for you. And we also just brewed kombucha in your bake shop. And then then we can use your health certificate. Completely legal. Completely fine.
Yeah.
And she was like, that's like the deal of a century. I'll definitely take it. So we had to work. So we worked in a bakery 3 days. One of us, you know, me, Dinah, Vanessa, took a night and every week. And then we made everything there. And then we expanded our farmer's market empire to 7 farmer's markets
weekly. Wow.
Doing that.
How much does 1 2.5-gallon jug?
About a case.
About a case?
About a 12-pack of 16-ounce bottles. We brew it one case at a time.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, dude.
That's a lot. So you're growing. You're doing the farmer's market. When does it start to tip? Because it's still the three of you involved, right? Yeah. Like you're like every hour putting in is the three of you. When do you start going like, I don't need to be the guy making it and selling it? How does that start to change? How does the word start to get out? When do you start to like tip it over to more of the, what you think of like a beverage business?
Yeah, instead of working in the business, going to working on it.
Kind yeah,
of. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it helps to have some financial investment, which we did not in the beginning. I mean, this was everything was, you know, I think we put the $2,000 or something we had together. Right? And then we were contacted by a venture capital company called First Beverage Group, and they became our first investor. And they said, oh, gosh, you know, we've been looking for a kombucha company. We've been trying them all. And
what is that world like? Because it definitely is trend-based, right? Because like kombucha definitely has had a moment. But is there a window to get in? Because now I feel like there's so many kombuchas that it probably maybe is not as enticing as when you were getting started when there was less kombucha in the market.
I couldn't speak for venture capital people. They have a mind of their own. I would say venture capitalists, there's a period of time during which their investment must mature.
Yeah.
Let's say I call it between 5 and 7 years. And like it can't exist on trend only.
Yeah. Right?
They need to find... Also, they don't run the business. And they're not capable of it. It's not what they do. It's not their job. And I'll say it a lot. And again, that's just... They don't do it. And thank God.
Right.
And so they need strong founders. They need founders that have a vision, that are able to pivot. It's a 5 to 7 year job. You know what I mean? Before the investment matures in some one way or another. And so you need to be able to pivot. You need to be able to grow the brand. Like for us, we've relied on kombucha this whole time. We don't have any other products. Whereas if you look at other, you know, brand food companies, brand portfolios, you can have many different kinds of beverages,
sure,
or food or beverage. And so, you know, I think they're looking for people who are going to make the investment work. They're business people and they're going to own it.
Gotcha. So when you start making the business working for you and you're not working for the business, when did that start to change?
It started to change kind of right before we got this investment.
Sure.
We were really thinking about it.
And what year is this?
This is summer of 2013.
So you've been in it for
about a year. About a year.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. We went after it hard.
Yeah.
Like we all quit our jobs. Like Dinah and Vanessa had really good jobs. I had a job.
Yeah.
And they quit their jobs. Like Vanessa's job was paying for her MBA at USC. And she was like midway through, she's like, I'm going to quit. And we're like, okay.
You're like, I just want you to remind you, that's your decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we were all high on this thing at the same time. Yeah, so we're like, yeah, you go, girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like,
open up another case of the booze.
Let's do that. Yeah. And so we kept, you know, and then Dinah was the last one to quit her job. She did a really good job. So then it all kind of, it was all very fast. But when you make that leap, it becomes like failure's not an option. And then that really helps you too.
But you had to have failures.
Oh, yeah.
What's, we don't have to get into all of them.
Yeah.
But what was the one early on where you're like, I don't know if this is going to be the thing we thought it was going to be.
I mean, there was one time, so like American Express kept calling us, and like you were like, "Dude, I don't have
your money.
Like, I don't care what you're going to tell me. Like,
yeah.
If I had your money, I would pay you."
Yeah.
And so we were.
I hate these calls as much as you do.
Yeah, listen, I don't like this either, man. So they were calling us and calling us, and it was at the time that we were like negotiating for our first round of investment, and like,
right.
We had never dealt with investors at all. We had no idea. And so we were like midway through all the negotiations. We were like, okay, listen, we have to call them. And we do have to tell them about this credit card situation. Like, we can't hide
it. Yeah, you can't hide it.
And we called them and they were like, we're not surprised.
Yeah.
So.
It's so funny when you think and they're like, yeah, no, that's why we're here.
Yeah.
We're here with the checkbook.
We're like, wait a minute. You guys have never been in business? We had a whole different idea.
No, we thought you guys had a balanced book.
Yeah. No. We're like, yeah, we know.
So, you know, you get the investment, you get the brand. How do you build it? Like, how do you, now that you're up and running, now that you know that, you know, you're coming into work tomorrow, you got the backing, what's growth look like to... you know, breakthrough, people buying it, you know, what are you doing? When do you know that things are shifting?
Okay, so this is a product that you buy on the shelf at grocery stores and elsewhere. So one of the first things you can do is get your label right.
Yeah.
It's always there. It's what people see when they approach the beverage cooler. So for us, you know, we had some early iterations and they were really epic. And then we kind of pulled it together and got that. I think that was a good first step.
Yeah.
And then I think, after that, I think it was about getting the right type of personnel on. Like, we need someone focused on sales all the time.
Sure. I mean, sales is, it's a very special job.
Very special job. And then we also needed somebody focused on production all the time. And we made a big hire in that arena.
Now,
so that was huge for us.
And now, how did you start breaking into supermarkets? Because that is one of the most complicated, tough things. Things that, you know, if you're talking about cliff jumping that you might not know about going in, which is like getting products on shelf.
Yeah.
And getting in with like the right distribution people, especially in like places like New York, where there are certain distribution people who have strangleholds on those bodegas and
they get in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you deal with that?
Oh, well, good looks and sparkling personality.
Absolutely.
Is required. I mean, no, I, you know, with the grocery stores, we always... think of it as like, you know, make a little chart. There's you and there's your competitors. And everything that they're doing, you just must do better.
Yeah.
You must. And not just like, oh, I know it's better. No, no, no. It needs to be evidently better to anybody witnessing it. So like a good example is the very first grocery chain we got into. It's a grocery chain around here in LA called Gelson's.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Vanessa and I, we would bring this guy, the buyer, we'd like bring him coffee, we'd like show up at his office all the time.
Sure.
And then finally, this is like kind of like music, right? You're like showing up and then
and
then bang, they're like, all right, kid, I'll give you a talk. And we're like, ooh. And then we were ready and we just really promised that we would do more demos, which is like, here, would you like a sample
in
person?
Sure.
And that we would show up at the stores, we would help the employees pack out the shelves and make everything look nice, and we would give them really favorable terms and things like that. And we did that, and you know, there was no nonchalance about it. Like, we didn't take anything for granted. It was, and we still don't. You got to stay incredibly hungry because there is somebody always right there.
I mean, especially with something like kombucha, and it's like hip and it's alternative. There is a you. Now that you 10 years ago in their apartment somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there
in
is.
Venice, brewing up a Scooby.
Yep.
There's one thing I want to touch on before we run out of time, because even though you stopped playing music professionally, I know that it still plays a part in the office and like when you're brewing.
Yes.
So what's your brewing music?
All right.
When you're putting it together.
Okay. So, kombucha sits like in a dark room and it ferments. So picture, if you can, like, you know, 100, 200,000 little glass jars just kind of sitting there.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, and that's the fermentation process. Now, back in the day when we started, there's always like these rumors about like there's like a, you know, main competitor company in kombucha. We are like, oh, they, you know, they play like Indian chants. And things like that to help increase the spirituality or something like that of the kombucha. I don't know. We heard something along those lines.
Sure.
That was like the rumor. And again, I was thinking, we have to be different. Like, we can't play Indian chants.
No,
I mean, come on. And like, so I thought there's a really great classical music station around here called KUSC and 91.5 in LA. And at night, there's Jim Sveda, who's like a legend in this world. And so I used to play, I still do it sometimes so I can get away with it, but it's just, I have to like bring a boombox in there. But for years, as soon as we walk out, like the last thing you do before you turn the lights out is like, just turn on 91.5 and let them listen to classical music. We thought, well, that would harmonize them, and they would feel really balanced. You know, they would, you know, and they would kind of, you know, it's like Baby Mozart, you know, which has been debunked, but whatever. Baby Mozart, you know, but for the kombucha.
Sure.
What are you gonna do? Like, not play Mozart for your kid?
Yeah. What are you gonna do?
You have a kid. Play Mozart.
I have a kid.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm not gonna play Mozart because
You love him. Her.
I love her, and if there's a 1% chance that makes her smarter, you got to do it.
You gotta do it.
You know you have to do it. You gotta do it. Justin, thank you so much. Where can people get Health Aid?
Oh, gosh. Anywhere that you buy kombucha presently. But, I mean, any grocery store basically should have it. If you're in New York, all the bodegas carry it. Target, Walmart, you name it. We're growing all the time, but pretty much everywhere.
Awesome. And if you had to pick a favorite, I know it's like picking a favorite child. Favorite flavor?
I don't have a problem picking a favorite child. I'm just kidding.
Well, when you have one kid, it's really easy.
Yeah, it's really easy.
Mine's Josephine. She's my favorite.
She's great.
Yeah, she's wonderful. Number one.
But compared to what could be, you don't know.
Oh, man.
No, it's okay. So, favorite. Actually, it's our newest flavor. It's our jalapeno kiwi cucumber. Mm. I know you said you don't love jalapeno.
Not a jalapeno guy.
That's okay. I'm not either, but it's only a little bit spicy, and it's like really cooled off by the cucumber. Awesome. I love it so much.
Awesome. Well, Justin, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Appreciate the bottle, too. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes and then a live performance coming up on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you.
100 Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are at the legendary Danger Bird Records studio in beautiful Silver Lake. We are with Tropa Mágica, the Pacheco brothers, David and Renee. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
That's Renee's mating call.
We're actually only doing answers in whistle form only, so you are all set. Interesting. Interesting insight.
So leave the smoke signals outside.
So you guys are brothers. Who's the older brother?
We like to play around with people, so depends on the day of the week.
Depends on the day?
Yeah, sometimes Renee could be the older one, sometimes I could be the older one.
All right, so did you guys grow up playing together? When you guys start getting into music, mom and dad into music, grandpa, grandma into music?
No, we were just always together. We grew up together, bonded at a very early age. And as we became teenagers, we went our own separate routes, but we were eventually reunited, not just by music, but also by marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Renee caught me smoking weed. I started smoking weed a little bit before him, and I would smoke it outside of the house.
Smelled good.
And then he's just like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, fuck." And I'm like, "You want to try it?"
And then if you don't let me try it, I'm going to tell my mom.
Oh, yeah. That's always a good thing. You know, as a brother, the way they let your brother do things, be like, "I'm going to tell mom and dad."
Yeah, and then we had a day where we both ditched, and we bought like a gram of, at the time, it wasn't clinical weed. It was, you either got like a Pretendo or like a...
Chronic was the main thing, and Kush was coming out.
Kush was like 25 bucks a gram or something.
We got Chronic, though, and it's the best I've ever heard the Doors, Riders on the Storm.
Yeah, I think the Doors were meant for smoking weed or maybe even like Pink Floyd, too, huh?
Yeah.
We got to do the stoner things, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, I've been smoking weed long enough, and I mean, there's a lot of people out there who smoke weed like at in big amounts, to the point where like the best high you're ever gonna get was when you first tried it.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, because man, those were one of the days where I was like, oh man, this is something. Now I'm just like, I can like, you know, function with it. So it's a little different. But when I get to remember back to those days, Rider on the Storms, leaning my head, thinking I'm floating, but I'm falling off the couch. You know, it was cool, man. It's cool.
Yeah. So when did you guys go from smoking weed and listening to music to smoking weed and making music?
Right away. Once we kind of were like both smoking weed, because at the time, like, it was still taboo.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, you're not supposed to be smoking weed. Once we started doing that...
Especially with, like, a Mexican family.
Yeah, we started bonding, and, like, our interests started kind of bonding as well, you know, forming together. We would go to
shows just to smoke weed sometimes.
Yeah, because, you know, I couldn't smoke at the house, and, like, I wasn't young enough to, like, I wasn't old enough to go to my own places.
But you're like, let him take me to shows. It's a safe spot.
We would go to places like the Smow or like backyard shows or Pear Space. It's not there anymore, but right there on Glendale, it used to be right there.
Yeah.
And we would go to those spots. They were all ages spots, and you could smoke and
Yeah, like anybody who's like trying to try something new outside of your limits, you know, you're gonna end up betraying either your parents' trust a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
Because you know they have their way of.
But it's not supposed to be mean. It's just you gotta be.
I didn't do it as an offense to them. Yeah. I just really dug it.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was, and it kept me out of trouble.
So being Mexican in like the punk rock scene, like with the smell, things like that, which is not always. I mean, it's mostly white at times, like those like DIY underground scenes.
Yeah.
Where did you guys feel that you fit in? What did you guys want to do musically? Like, what did you? Or did you just never even see that because you both, it was just like, we love the music,
race is not an issue at all.
Yeah, surprisingly for us, it was never an issue. Like, we would see, like, it wasn't until we went to college and we took our first, like, Chicano studies class that we started, like, I blame college, actually, for, like, racist.
I didn't know racism existed until I went to college.
No, it's kind of true. Like, you know, you understand, like, social structures.
It leaves you mad, but, I mean, so...
If you can find a
solution to, like, to, you know, like, know that about you and kind of go your way, and, like, it kind of makes you stronger. You know, like, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Or stranger.
So we embraced, like, all types of music. Like, when we were going to The Smell, this was around the time when, like, Mika Miko and Noise were blowing up.
Mid-late 2000s.
Because being Mexican in the punk scene, like, that's all I saw at backyard shows. Like, everybody, you know, like, we all looked like each other.
I remember we saw Fiddler, like, at the Five Star Bar.
Wow. But it was, like, our interest in music that took us other places, and we weren't really thinking, like, racism. We were just very much thinking melodies, structures, rhythms.
The cool thing about the LA underground scene was that it was a lot different than the East LA backyard punk scene, because in the East LA backyard punk scene, it was very, like, everything was the same. It felt like everybody was trying to sound either as hard and heavy as you could or as ska as you could. But with, like, places like The Smell and Pear Space, or, like, the little places that were around at the time, like the Echo Curio on Sunset, or there was the Alkid Gallery right there on Glendale, too.
Yeah,
those places,
true.
Like, booked a lot of different types of bands. Like, you know, you had Dimeshi, or you had, like, you heard of them?
Oh, yeah.
Well, like, I remember when Echo Park was, like, starting to pick up its pace
at its birth of gentrification, like, you know. But, like, we didn't even know that term at the time. We just knew that, like, there was something going on. We're like, and then it was until later we're like, oh, that's the term for that.
Yeah, because we were still kids, you know. As kids, you grow up, you're sort of thinking, kinda like, naive. Everything's pretty, everything's beautiful in the world. And then you sort of learn the truth a little bit here and there. And you're kind of like, oh, shit. And so that doesn't, like, we tried not to let that affect us as creatives. We try to just sort of, like, understand that, you know, understand the truth and let that help us continue grow as creatives.
Awesome. Well, let's hear a song, and then we're gonna get back into, when we come back, we'll talk about the first band and how you guys started defining your sound.
Yeah, definitely.
What's the first song you guys are gonna play?
The first song we're gonna play is called Morena.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Any story behind it?
Morena, it actually started with a riff that Jason would play at sound checks, and I'm like, hey, play that riff again, and then we wrote a melody around it and some chord structure around it.
Do you want to shout out the other two guys in the room?
Yeah, so we have Davis on piano. He plays piano, keyboard, or like synth, organ kind of sounds. And then Jason, who's been with us, he's actually been a fan of our music since, like, before Tropa Magica, and he once posted a video on Instagram where he's playing one of our songs, and then 4 months later, he joined the band.
That has got to be the most awesome, surreal.
Oh, yeah.
That was a good day. That was a good call or email,
and
right?
It's funny because he was joking around saying, oh, you're hired. And 4 months later, sure enough.
Man.
There you go.
Hey, dream big. Yeah. You never know. You never know. Take a risk. All right, here we go. Tropa Magica live on Snacky Tunes at Danger Bird Record Studios.
We'll be right back.
Real hard.
Thank you.
So before you were the band that you are now, you actually had an earlier iteration, The Commons.
Yeah.
And you guys, in addition to that, also sort of defined a new type of sound that was sort of like cumbia, but like your own sort of like punk rock thing. So how did you guys start your first band? When did you guys decide that you wanted to play together? And then how did you start to define your sound, especially when it was something completely new?
We decided to play together when David needed a drummer.
Oh.
And I already had been practicing drums myself.
And you had the blackmail weed thing on it, too.
So everything fell into place from there.
Yeah, and then, like, coming out of the, like, experiencing the LA scene around that time, you know, like, late 2000s, you know, before 2010, it was very interesting because at that same time we went to college. You know, we had dropped out of like college, like community college, and we were just working, trying to do music. And,
yeah.
And then we decided to go back to school, and it was around that time where we started like kind of like embracing our roots more and trying to like find like our identity per se. And we started listening to more of regional music. You know, like the roots of Chicha had a big influence on us, but since we had like all this like these years of experience with bands like Mika Miko, Meishi, you know, we weren't gonna be able to do it authentically anymore. So at that point,
because that kinda, punk had seeped in.
Yeah, at that point, we were like, we were trying to
get inside of you.
We were trying to be No Age for a good while. Like we were trying to do it as a two piece, and then
ooh.
Yeah, and that was hard.
Yeah, Kumi is a two piece. I don't know if that's
yeah. You need the bass.
You need that bass. You need that driving bass.
And then we went through like a dozen basses, just trying to like gel, find our sound, and
find our voice.
Yeah,
it took us a lot of ingesting to do. We were very curious, so we were experiencing a lot of different bands, going to different, you know, just going to different areas that
And then Boyle Heights, that's when we started noticing more like Latino bands, like people that like had similar backgrounds like as us, but it was kind of weird because we felt like outcast there because we felt like the music we like was too white, you know, like, and they were more like hardcore, like rootsy, like, you know, like you gotta play cumbia straight up like this, and we felt very like, fucking distortion,
this hit, yeah.
I mean, did you find as you were sort of defining yourself and you found yourself one foot in you know, the punk scene, which is like the white scene, and then like the Boyle Heights, which is more of the Mexican scene. Like, how long did it take for you to sort of find comfortability and acceptance with the music you were making? Like, when did that start to gel?
3 years. It was with the Commons. It was 3 years. It wasn't until we saw this band called Cumbia Queers from Argentina, and they came to Boyle Heights to play at this little dive bar, and they do like. It's like a bunch of girls, you know, ladies, women. They do the cumbia style, and it's very aggressive, like, you know, with distorted guitars, synths.
I don't think it's aggressive. I just think it's unapologetic.
Yeah, like
they're gonna do what they're there to do and what they wanted to hear.
They did a cumbia version of Iron Man, but Black Sabbath, and that's when Renee and I looked at each other, and we were just like, boom, like light bulb went on, and it's like, it's okay to be different. Like,
yeah, because prior to hearing them play cumbia in that form, in that style, in which it wasn't just like your typical clean, or not typical, that's messed up, just like it wasn't your clean.
Traditional.
Yeah, it wasn't your cut clean, you know, form of cumbia. This was something a lot more grittier and something that we could accept as like cumbia punk, you know?
Yeah.
That attitude like just really called to us and let us know like, it's okay what you're doing. You know, like you guys aren't playing it the way it's supposed to be sounding, but through hearing them, it was like a beautiful blessing, like, keep doing it, keep doing it. Because they did a cover of Iron Man in a cumbia, you know, cumbia style. I'd never heard anything like that.
So it's like, for those of y'all that are listening that don't necessarily know what cumbia is, it's very much defined by its bass rhythms and its percussions. And the percussions would be very much like a guido sound, which sounds like a...
So any song that's on like 4-4, you can turn it into cumbia.
I mean, you guys have been known to cover Nirvana.
Yeah, we covered some Nirvana songs. We did, we joked around and played a bunch of different little cumbia melodies.
Now, you did the Commons for a while.
6 years.
6 years. And then you decided to change to Tropa Mágica. What made the change? Why did you want to change? And was it hard to rebrand yourself as a band, but not changing, like, who you guys are? It wasn't like you, like, one guy left.
Yeah.
Like, what made you want to decide to change it up, and how did the fans, how did the people who loved you guys deal with that as well?
So this is a three-part question.
Three-part question.
So
what made you want to change?
What made us want to change, how did that change go, and how did the fans take it?
Yeah.
My answer for the first one might be different to David's, but for me it was just very simple. It was an evolution. When we started the first band, it was the first name that, or when we started the Commons, the name was just something we grabbed really quick and ran with it because we needed a name. But as we kept growing
musicians,
what
we kind of embraced was like, you know, it wasn't the name that was going to define us, it was our sound that was going to define us. And
yeah, and so afterwards we realized like, okay, now we want to switch it up, because for me, like, we had changed as musicians, our sound completely shifted, and so it was like, David Kidd came up to me and was like, what do you think about changing the band name to this? And at first I struggled, but it immediately became clear to me. It's like, yeah, we've become something else. We should call ourselves for something, because now we were able to name ourselves as opposed to just take whatever name we could have.
Yeah,
so we had a more bigger sense of purpose, and we knew what we wanted of what we were going to continue to do.
Yeah, because with the Commons, what happened was that we had another band called Hello, My Name is Red. The acronyms for that was like HMNR, and we did that for 4 years, and then we stopped that band to do the Commons, and we had a radio show at KXIU, and they were like, so what should we bill you guys under? And we're like, okay, well, we threw that name out there, and then it just kind of stuck.
Yeah, because we played a show once right before we became the Commons as a no-name band, where I did a song without drums. It was really awkward.
What inspired the shift, too, was also like, you know, 2017 for the Commons, our band, it was a really great year. We played Coachella, you know, we had done Tropicalia. We got a lot of good press, LA Weekly, you know, LA Times were talking about our band. And to me, it felt like, all right, what are we going to do as a band that's going to surpass this, that's going to, you know, kind of create the next thing? And in my head, it's just like, there's nothing. We're like, what, we're going to win a Grammy as the Commons? And I didn't feel that, like, that was going to happen with the Commons, so I was just like, you know, just reinvent ourselves, let it die so that something stronger could come out of it.
Like a Pajonix, Phoenix.
From the ashes.
Yeah.
And then the fans. The fans come with you?
Slowly, yeah. Like, I think now, like, it's gaining more legitimacy as, like, we got booked for, like, Desert Days, you know.
Yeah, I think it just took a little while because they didn't know what songs they were going to come in here. They were used to hearing the songs that we had laid out for them. But until now that we, like, been producing some work for them to hear, I feel like they're kind of like, okay, the water's not that cold. I'm down to dip in.
Yeah, and then we're touring, and so as people are getting more excited, like, oh, like, we haven't toured, like, since last year, and we're a band that, like, constantly tours, so. Yeah, like, us now releasing an EP, singles, and an LP coming out, well, which, by the time this airs, it should already be out, it creates definitely, like, a foundation for which previous fans can now base their judgment, because before, it's just like, oh, my God, they're just changing, and there was nothing to back it up, unless you're, like, diehard fan, yeah. Which we do have some.
Our first show to an audience of Tropa Magica, there were people who showed up, but nobody knew what they were in for, and so they didn't know exactly how to react.
But they were down. They were down to swim with this.
Awesome. All right, well, let's hear our next song. What are we going to hear?
The next song is going to be Cupacabras, to give you an example of the psychedelic cumbia punk version of what we do.
Awesome. All right.
Cupacabras.
Here we go. We'll be right back. Oh man, that rips. It rips so good. So I want to go back a little bit into the process of inventing a new sound.
Okay.
Because I know we touched on it a little bit in the last segment, but I really don't want to undermine or underplay really how amazing it is to come up with something that unique. And in setting out to do this new sound, did you guys have a conversation about it? Did you guys go, we want to do it? And because I know that you've named it the Psychedelic Cumbia Punk. Like, when did you realize that you were on this new journey? When did you realize that you had this new sound that did take from, you know, the traditional cumbia sound and the backyard punk scene?
That, I think, started with the song called Psychedelic Dream, in which it was very guitar-oriented, and then Renee began playing this drum that kind of became her signature kind of sound, guitar and drum sound. Which is like what you call, like, what do you call that? Like a soca, no?
It's not what I call it. It's what it's called. It's called soca. It's and like a Jamaican. A lot of people, when they hear it, they'll think, oh, it's reggaeton.
Yeah.
But no, hell no, reggaeton took it from soca.
Yeah. But it was definitely a process. And once we got in that vibe of like, okay, this is our sound, like, it just like, you know, and that was always our goal, because I feel like any great band, you recognize them by their sound, you know? You don't recognize them by their name or their logo. Like, I mean, that's obviously a factor. Like, you know, Rolling Stones have the tongue or something, the Doors have their logo, but you recognize their sound. And then for us, that was very important. Like, we need to develop a sound that's ours. And so, I mean, we were performing with bands like Chicano Batman, you know? Just like all sorts of bands that were like blowing up, and so the competition was real, you know. But it was also very cool to see like bands like Chicano Batman like touring with Jack White and like kind of demonstrating that like, hey, like making it as a musician is like very possible, you know, coming from East LA. And so,
I mean, as you've seen the demographics in America change, because obviously growing up in LA and East LA,
yeah,
you know, there's Hispanic, Mexican.
Yeah,
like it's.
So
it's,
you don't feel like a minority in Southern California,
right? But once you get out, you know, and as you see different cities change with different people, do you find more acceptance across the country for your music, or does that not even play into it? Like, you just, you know, now because you have such a unique sound and are well known, it doesn't matter what the community is. People just love the music.
I think we were.
No, it does a little bit, because when we were the Commons, you're going to think like, oh, this might be like a
garage white band or something.
White boys garage band. But now you hear Tropa Manica, you know, you might think like, oh, you know, like, just, it's like, it's maybe the carnival's in town. Yeah.
What we were lucky and fortunate and blessed with is that, like, you know, we met good, like, networks, you know, like Burger Records was really interested in us when, like, this is like 2014. And, like, you know, they were still doing a lot of stuff. And so when we first toured, they presented the tour, which was like really cool, because people would come out to shows because we were a burger band, you know, quote unquote, like we were a burger band, and they had no idea what we sounded like until they saw like a poster in their local, like, you know, local community, and they're like, hey, there's a burger band, and then they look us up and they're like, you know, you guys don't sound like a burger band or look like a burger band.
I mean, I have to imagine that the vibe when you guys jump on, especially your like normal indie punk show. Mm. Probably gets a little bit more dancey, a little bit more, like, do you see kids who normally would maybe just be arms folded or a little bit more stoic, get a little bit more loose?
You know, it's a trip, because when we toured with Fiddlar, we did like 3 dates with them in San Francisco, Santa Cruz, and Seattle, and, you know, their audience is predominantly like white audience, I would assume, but they have like a good Latino audience. They have a diverse audience, but it's predominantly white. Yeah. And
it was funny watching them dance cumbia.
Yeah, they got down, like, you know, it's like.
But their enthusiasm was just so that, like, that's at the end of the day, like, what you give it up to. Like, it's not to make fun of them, you know, like, why I pointed that out. It's just that their enthusiasm was in the right place.
It's like us like dancing to bands like we were saying earlier, like Mika Miko and stuff, and like being brown kids, you know, dancing to like.
Yeah.
And it's like that's like. Yeah, we like, vice versa.
Yeah, we look like a Doug Trio, you know, causing an earthquake. Pokemon reference, hey.
Let me tell you about a kid that turns into a car. One, right?
Inside joke.
Now that you got the new album coming out, you know, you're playing festivals as the new band, where do you see the band going? Where do you want to go? Because now that you've hit the reset button, like you said, you did Coachella, you got people talking about you, but you know, obviously you want to get that with the new band, but then how do you go beyond what you do with the Commons?
Leave the U.S.
Yeah.
Tour internationally. That's the goal. I mean, to become an international band where we tour Europe, Mexico, South America, because I feel like once you break over there in those areas, then when we come back to the States, it'll be like, it's just like people like are followers sometimes, you know, which just kind of sucks, but like, it's like mass thinking, you know, like group think, and it's like, you know, very
big thing. You're not going to change history. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it is
so,
what it is.
So, and then like, in a sense, like,
you got to go with the flow.
Yeah.
It's like they told Bruce Lee, you know, like,
yeah.
It's like but everybody, fight the water.
But,
be the
but
water.
This is not to say that anybody that's like picking up to what we're doing right now, like that we categorize under that. Like, no, like, we really appreciate like everybody that's tuning into Tropa Mágica. Like, we have a lot of new people that are tuning into it for the first time who don't even know that we had another band, which is really cool. You
that's
know?
Bonus music.
Yeah.
You know, where you get in the band and you go like, wait, they had another band with three
exactly.
albums? Like, oh. But the funny thing is that like the moment we decided to call it Tropa Mágica, everyone was like, oh my God, no. It was like, bitch, when we were the Commons, what? Where was that shit at? Yeah. So y'all gotta lay off and, you know, just chill out. Let the current flow. Calm the fuck down.
But now they're with you, and now they're going to see you.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, whether they're with us or they're not, like, we appreciate those who do and reach out to us. But, like, I've told David, like, you know, like, because when David and I, we practice by ourselves, like, just doing stuff, whether there's an audience or not, we're going to give it our all.
I mean, I'm seeing it today.
So that's, like, that's something that's just beautiful. And, like, for those who do ride along the journey, thank you. Appreciate you. And there's more to come.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I want to thank you guys. I want to make sure we have enough time for one more song. But where can people get the new album? Where can people find you online?
People can find us on www.tropamagica.com or like on anything, like all social media, Spotify.
LinkedIn for the classy people. Just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding.
I don't
kidding,
think we have one of those.
So what are you going to take us out with?
We're going to take you out with a little medley. It's like an instrumental medley. Well, the first part is actually from the new album. It's called Ya Viejo. And then it's going to go into a...
We wrote it to our older selves.
Yeah, this is a song that Renee and I wrote.
The day we're hunched over, gray hair, and just like, this is what we wrote.
Like when our Quincy Jones documentary
exactly.
comes out.
Yeah, see, yeah, man, because the Quincy Jones documentary came
Have
out,
you seen
and
it?
It's
on
really
Netflix?
And it's really more about his final act, reminiscing on his first acts, first and second act.
Okay.
But I really just appreciated this idea of like,
hey, you got to make art and music that your future self has to live up to.
Yeah, all right.
Awesome. Well, I want to
thank for posterity.
Andy Dangerberg Records.
Thank you, Andy, for making it sound good.
Woo! Making
put
you
some
sound
reverb
great.
On it.
And thank you to Heritage Radio. This is Snacky Tunes, Tropa Mágica. See you next week. One last sip of beer before here we go.
It's the last sip.
Talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.